This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. Today is the Friday recap where we revisit a few of the most interesting conversations we had this week. Up first, we get an update on Roncalli High School's federal case involving the firing of a gay guidance counselor. We're joined by Erica Heron, education reporter at the Indy Star, to get an update on Roncalli High School's federal case involving the firing of a gay guidance counselor. Thank you so much for joining us, Erica.
Thanks for having me.
Erica, can you explain sort of the background of this case for people who may be hearing about it for the first time?
Sure. This started back in the fall of 2018, actually, with two guidance counselors at Roncalli High School. The first was Shelley Fitzgerald. She was suspended that fall, and that's kind of what kicked off a whole series of events that led to the lawsuit we're talking about today, which was filed by her co-director of guidance, Lynn Starkey. Both were eventually fired at the end of the 2018-19 school year because they had entered in, they were both gay women in same-sex marriages. The Archdiocese of Indianapolis and the high school decided not to renew their contracts because of that, saying they were in violation of a clause in the contract that says they must live within kind of the teachings of the Catholic Church.
And so this is not the first time we're seeing a case like this in Indiana. It sounds like this is one of many now.
One of several. There was also another court case, not in federal court, though, but involving a firing of another gay teacher from Cathedral High School. So three kind of separate cases against the Archdiocese, two involving Roncalli and one Cathedral High School. The Fitzgerald case is still working its way through the courts, though.
And so right now we're talking specifically, I guess, about the most recent ruling where the judge ruled in favor of Roncalli High School. Is that my understanding?
That's correct. Yes. The district court judge, federal district court judge, ruled in favor of Roncalli and the Archdiocese, basically saying that they have the right to hire employees that kind of adhere to their faith. It's something called the ministerial exception.
And what exactly is that exception, if you can give us some insight?
Sure. So basically, it just says that these employment discrimination claims, they can't be filed against the church because they have autonomy to choose their leaders, including teachers and guidance counselors, and kind of set the rules for those, and that they can hire people that adhere to the teachings of their faith. So it's an exception from these kind of federal employment discrimination claims for religious institutions.
And so the guidance counselor was a counselor. I read your article for about 40 years. And this started happening about a year or two ago. Was there anything that led to it getting to this point?
Yeah, so Lynn Starkey worked at Roncalli for almost 40 years, a variety of positions, the last, last one being co-director of guidance. She and her wife were married back in 2015. It wasn't until, though, the 2017-18 school year that she was asked to sign an employment contract that has this ministerial language, that clause in it. And then it wasn't until the next year then that it really became an issue. And it seems like that all kind of started because her co-worker, Shelley Fitzgerald, a parishioner, pulled her marriage license, turned it in to a local priest who then took the issue to the Archdiocese, who then started working on kind of enforcing these clauses in their schools.
Is that even legal to go and pull people's private information? I mean, maybe it's public record, but...
Yeah, I believe that marriage licenses are part of the public record.
Right. I'm just wondering what the precedent is for something like this. I'm not going to try to do like a legal quiz of you right now, but in your experience in covering this story, does this seem to be on par with the usual situation with Catholic schools in Indiana, or is this an anomaly?
So this has certainly happened. Indiana's not the only place that this issue has come up. It certainly was the Archdiocese of Indianapolis seems to be more aggressive in pursuing these cases or these teachers here, and, you know, in the last couple of years than in other places. We had kind of more instances of this happening here than, you know, other areas around the country have really seen. But it's certainly not not particular just to Indianapolis.
And how have people in the Catholic community reacted since these firings started happening?
It was really divisive for the Catholic community here locally, and not just locally, kind of, you know, around the country, people have weighed in. But you had, you know, a lot of folks who sided with the church and said that, you know, these people aren't either following their in the contract language, or they're not adhering to the Catholic faith. So that the church should have the right to do this, and were very supportive. And you had another group of people, both Catholic and non-Catholic, who were really upset about this and disappointed in the church. There have been folks within the Catholic community, especially young people, really calling on the church to change and become a more you know, tolerant and accepting place of these LGBTQ employees. But so far, you know, the Archdiocese has kind of stuck to its message that it has a constitutional right to hire people that, you know, stick to its teachings.
Right. I just wonder, though, like in jobs like this, if you're signing a contract, it's kind of vague, maybe. And maybe it's up to the, is it the institution that's just deciding what they want to be included and not?
Do you mean as far as like what constitutes a violation of church teaching?
Right.
Yeah, so that was a question that came up, you know, kind of when all of this started to bubble up too, is what about other, you know, kind of violations of church teaching? And there were some people who said, well, you know, what about a teacher who isn't married but is living with someone, or, you know, hasn't gotten their marriage annulled, that sort of thing. And the church's position largely was that there, if there are other issues, or whenever an issue arises like this, they want to work with their employees first and, you know, kind of try and find some way to ameliorate that situation, either to get them on the right side kind of the church, if at all available. But in these cases, you know, the only way to do that for these folks would have been to end their marriages, and they weren't willing to do that.
If you're listening live and have questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Erica Heron, education reporter for the Indy Star, on the recent Roncalli case. Erica, has the church made any official statements about these firings?
The church for the last couple of years has really just been speaking through the group, the legal group that's been representing it. And the like most recent statement they've issued has just been celebrating, you know, their win in this case and their right to, you know, continue to set these kind of rules for employment, and that it really, you know, allows religious institutions to, you know, live up to and fulfill their religious mission.
And I also read in your article that they may appeal this case. Do you have any sense that that's going to happen? The woman who was fired?
Yeah, the Lynn Starkey, she actually filed her appeal with the Seventh Circuit yesterday. So that will go to the appeals court now.
Well, since the judge ruled in support of the Archdiocese in Roncalli, does that kind of put a damper on any other cases moving forward? Could that set precedent, do you think?
This particular ruling, so my understanding, and I'm not a legal expert, I'm an education reporter, but my understanding from talking with legal experts is that the actual district court ruling, so this most recent ruling, does not set precedent. But the appeals court decision could, in the three-state region that is under its jurisdiction, which is Indiana, Illinois, and Wisconsin. But it does certainly, you know, raise some questions about Shelley Fitzgerald's case, which is, of course, you know, very similar.
Mm-hmm. And so what does it mean in general when we talk about these sort of contracts? Is that mostly for that teachers have to sign? Because it sounds like it's something that popped up in the last few years. Is this exclusive to Catholic schools, or do you see it in other religious private schools?
We have seen it actually in other religious private schools as well. There was a case at a Lutheran high school last summer where an athletic trainer was also fired because she was gay. It has happened, you know, more at Catholic schools in this area, but it certainly does happen at other religious schools and institutions as well.
And so what are you thinking is the next sort of phase for this case or story that you're covering, if there's an appeal?
So certainly the appeal will be an interesting kind of process to watch because it could set precedent for other cases like it, including Shelley Fitzgerald's case, which is a little bit further behind kind of in the process. Then also the Cathedral High School teacher, his case is also in appeal. He lost his initial case and has since appealed that too. So waiting to see if there's any movement there or if kind of this next level continues to apply the ministerial exception, I think more broadly, at least in this case, than certainly than, you know, Lynn Starkey's lawyer was hoping would happen.
Were there any other examples of employees breaking the agreement that was outside of, you know, same-sex marriages?
No other cases we know of where people have been fired that I'm recently, you know, fired for breaking that agreement.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate you giving us the insight. We'll look forward to more of your reporting and the update on the case.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Erica Herron is an education reporter for the Indy Star. Coming up next, we'll revisit some of the other conversations we had over the last week. We'll hear from a housing expert to learn more about the national eviction moratorium and its impact on Hoosiers. You can always reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe, and it's the Friday recap where we revisit a few of the conversations we had over the last week. Coming up now, we're going to talk to housing experts to learn more about the national eviction moratorium and its impact on Hoosiers. We're talking to housing experts about the national eviction moratorium. With us now, we have three guests. Amy Nelson is executive director of the Fair Housing Center of Central Indiana. Andrew Bradley is policy director at Prosperity Indiana. And Brandon Beeler is the Housing Law Center director at Indiana Legal Services. Welcome to all of you. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. Amy, the national eviction moratorium was extended earlier this month. What changed exactly for folks who haven't been following this up to the minute?
The biggest change is that it gives people more time to get the rental assistance funds they may have qualified for. We have received reports, you know, certainly across the country as well as, you know, here in the state of Indiana, that it has taken a while for the entities, the city governments, state, and to get these programs up and running. And people may not have been aware that they may have qualified for these programs. So it gives people some time to be able to get their applications in, get the funds in, and get caught up.
You mentioned that people might not be aware they're eligible for some of these programs. What is the cause of that? Is there not enough being done to let people know there are options out there for them?
There certainly needs to be additional outreach conducted statewide to get the information to people. You know, people are living busy lives. They're trying to make ends meet right now. They're struggling with maybe taking care of, you know, an elderly parent, dealing with still issues around childcare, trying to get reemployed. And individuals just have a lot going on and may not be on social media, may not be following mainstream type news sites to know about the availability of rental assistance programs, or may even think that there's no way I'm going to qualify for that. And what we're trying to do, along with many of our partners, is trying to get the word out to please apply. Find out if you may qualify, because this is an opportunity for you to potentially get some funds to help you get caught up on unpaid rent.
Andrew, what has the reaction been so far to this moratorium extension as far as what you've seen?
Thanks so much for this conversation, first of all, Miriam. With the partners that we've talked with at Prosperity Indiana, we've started a series of regional meetings. And I think that everybody recognizes that this extension of the moratorium is really just kind of extending the length of time of a Band-Aid that covers a gaping wound. And that basically is the pre-existing housing stability and affordability crisis that we have in Indiana. And really the upshot is it gives us 2 more months to try to get as much of that emergency rental assistance that we just heard about into the hands of the tenants and the landlords who need it the most.
Do you think tenants are at all worried maybe to sign up for some of these programs because they're afraid of being penalized? I've heard in the past of programs where, you know, if it's found that you really don't qualify, then you have so much back pay to put back in. Is that the same situation here?
I think there, you know, it could certainly be instances like that with individual tenants. You may have folks that are, you know, frankly, a little worried about putting out any sort of personal information when they're going through a crisis that's as deep as housing instability and the fear that they may end up on the street and at risk of greater risk of catching COVID itself. And specifically, we've also heard about concerns about undocumented families being worried about applying. There's been some efforts from the federal administration to make sure that it's clear that they are eligible for this assistance. But it certainly can reach down into other populations as well.
Yeah, that's got to be hard, you know, especially for undocumented families facing so much hardship and then not being able to get help because they're so afraid of what could happen.
Absolutely. And, you know, frankly, there have been a number of changing guidelines, and every different recovery program has some of its own specific requirements. And I think that's why it's that much more important, like Amy said, that we take advantage of all the funds and the available ways to get this information into people's hands proactively so that the information comes to them when they're in need.
Whenever we talk about housing and tenants, there's always the side of the landlords. And Brandon, several lawsuits have already been filed from landlord groups across the country against this moratorium. Why are they so against it?
Sure. Well, first, thanks, Miriam, for hosting the conversation and for the invitation to participate. You know, I want to answer that question. I want to also echo Amy and Andrew's points about the fact that getting the rental assistance to tenants and landlords is frankly a critical need of Hoosier renters here in the state. As far as the moratorium goes, and this is kind of maybe getting into the legal arguments here, is back on June 29th with the last eviction moratorium that the CDC had out that was essentially in place since last September, Justice Kavanaugh and his concurring opinion, while they let the moratorium stand for another month, and again directed, as we probably have heard a lot in the news, directed Congress to act if it needed to be extended more, the CDC here really did revise its order here to try to comply, because the CDC's order is under its broad authority to issue nationwide orders that prevent the spread of communicable and infectious disease, which is what this moratorium is specifically directed at trying to do, hence why it's coming from the Centers for Disease Control. So here, when they've directed it, and now the difference between the two moratoria, I should say, is that this is directed on a county-by-county basis to counties that are experiencing high or substantially high spread of the disease. So just from the human element of this all, again, people keeping people protected from COVID-19, since we are still, in fact, in a pandemic. So where we are with the landlord challenge, I mean, part of it, I believe, is landlords arguing, you know, some in good faith that they are, you know, that they have had their businesses suffer because they're relying on rental income to maintain their properties, pay their property taxes and things like that. But also, I think that some of this has been some, you know, misinformation, some miscommunication and things like that. But just sort of where we are with the case is on Friday, the district court in D.C. issued a ruling on the current moratorium that's in place through October 3rd that upheld it. The reason the district court or the trial court upheld it was because it felt, you know, rightly so, that it had dicta from the D.C. District Court or the Court of Appeals from supporting the last moratorium. And as of this morning, we have learned that briefs are due for the challenge to the Court of Appeals in D.C. The Federal Court of Appeals in D.C. are due Wednesday, and the court, and we may have an issuing some opinion from the D.C. Circuit by the end of this week.
Do you think there's a chance the moratorium could end before the 60 days are over, or is it set in stone that we at least have 2 months on this?
We sure don't know. I'm not sure the speed of which the courts are going to look at this. So there's certainly a chance. I mean, we're keeping our eyes certainly on the D.C. Circuit and what they're going to do there, because the next step, depending on what the circuit, if they do act this week, it'll most likely either side will appeal it to the Supreme Court, and whether they will hold a hearing or do something on it, we don't know. So it is certainly something to keep an eye on.
Yeah, definitely. Well, Amy, as of Friday, all Indiana counties fell into the category of high COVID transmission, according to the definition set by the eviction moratorium. But when the moratorium extension was first announced, it was all but eight counties, I believe, that were considered high transmission. What would it have meant for the people living in those counties if they weren't part of this extension, if it was just pockets in the state that weren't able to be part of this?
Well, it would mean having to, you know, move right now during a pandemic, and you might not have anywhere that you can go. So the risk of homelessness is certainly very high. You got to remember that something that we really need to talk about, we end up being so focused on the here and now with the, you know, what happens with the eviction and the individuals, that immediate loss of home, that stability that's lost, kids changing schools, loss of furniture, items, things like that. But it's also there's a long-term impact that's going to follow families around for the next decade, because the sheer filing of an eviction, even if it wasn't justified, may have been retaliatory, may have been an attempt to get the tenant out because they wanted to increase the rent, may have been a landlord who refused to participate in the rental assistance program, and now that tenant is served with an eviction, but that is going to follow them around to their future housing because of how tenant screening is done nowadays, where individuals at most mainstream housing have to pass a background check. And unfortunately, just the filing of an eviction, whether or not a judge agreed with it or not, impacts people's ability to find future safe and affordable housing.
Wow, I didn't realize how far reaching this is. Do you think for landlords that try to give out eviction in retaliation to their tenants have been using what's happening with COVID and not getting rent on time as an excuse to get them out?
What was talked about in the first segment is that some landlords who refused to participate in the program used other means to get tenants out. Evictions never really stopped here in Indiana. We're one of the highest evicting, cities here in Indianapolis, but across the state, many of our cities, from small cities to large cities, are ranked as the highest evicting cities in the country. And that's been a problem. That was a problem before the pandemic, and the pandemic just exacerbated it as a result. So evictions were happening during the pandemic, and what we found was very often that landlord wasn't using the non-payment of rent as a reason for the eviction, which wasn't allowed under the different moratoriums, but was instead using things that they may not have used before, such as complaints about noise, issues around other sorts of lease violations. And those were more difficult then for the tenant than to challenge, and unfortunately would result in eviction. And then there's just the number of people who didn't meet the requirements necessarily for the moratorium, where they may have suffered COVID-related job loss, but then had to found a job, but it might not have been at the wage level of their previous job, and will then, result in some sort of impact then, with those individuals. But, here in Indiana, since the moratorium or since the COVID pandemic started last year, there have been over 54,000 eviction filings in the last 18 months here in the state of Indiana.
Wow, that's a lot.
If I can, Amy made some really important points there. I just want to highlight at least one of them is, yes, evictions are still happening here in Indiana. I think that maybe, for the casual viewer or someone who's just watching this and thinking, we've heard moratoria for the past year. First and foremost, yes, for those other lease violations, evictions are continuing throughout the state. But even for folks that are covered by the CDC eviction moratorium, people are being evicted for non-payment of rent as well, and some who may qualify for the protection. Very briefly, in order to be covered under the CDC moratorium, the tenant has to provide a copy of the declaration to their landlord to let them know they qualify and to kind of pause it. Now, there is a rule now out from federal law that landlords have to inform their tenants about it. But really, I've seen just here in central Indiana, especially sitting in courts, that not every court necessarily informs all the parties. Eviction court is generally kind of a how we call it, you know, it's a big group setting. And so everyone's in the gallery and kind of watching. Some courts, and the Supreme Court has put guidance out there, the Indiana Supreme Court, about how courts should try to inform everyone and make sure that everyone knows their protections. But that is not happening statewide, certainly. And so we are seeing even people who are probably covered under the moratorium still being evicted.
Is it fair to say this sounds kind of messy, like there's just not a lot of communication going on?
I think that's right. I think, you know, again, I know that we're trying to get all the courts in the same position with the same sort of policies. But, you know, courts here are all independent entities in each county. So it is a bit of a challenge, I think, from that era, from that space.
Well, Andrew, how effective has the moratorium been in protecting renters from eviction? I mean, because it sounds like there's so many different things going on. Does the moratorium necessarily prevent renters from being evicted that have other, like we were talking about earlier, noise disturbances or things like that?
Well, I think what Brandon was just talking about really kind of gets to some of the gaps between the aim of the moratorium and what maybe some of the popular perception might be and what the facts are on the ground. Mm-hmm. And something that's worth noting, Eviction Lab from Princeton University has shown, as Amy mentioned, over 54,000 evictions filed in Indiana during the moratorium. But back when there was a state moratorium that you might remember Governor Holcomb issued from March through early August of 2020, there really were very few evictions filed. That was a much more of a blanket eviction moratorium. It was very effective. But as Brandon mentioned, with the CDC moratorium, there's the onus in some cases is on the renter to proactively show that it applies to them, and then courts interpret that differently. That's why we see that over 54,000 filings.
Amy, is it possible we'll see a wave of evictions after this moratorium expires?
I have no doubt that we will see that. Whether it's in over a period of time, it's probably the more likely outcome, where the courts, you know, depending upon the court and how fast they move, and folks may be able to kind of get some funds together for a short term, but then we may see lease non-renewals and other types of efforts. My organization has been hearing about just dramatic increases in rent that is going to make, you know, finding housing or maintaining housing long term one of the repercussions of the evictions.
I've been reading that not just housing prices have been going up in some markets, but rentals are going up because there's just such a demand. And is that something that we're seeing in Indiana right now?
Absolutely. Indiana is a state that receives a lot of investor, out-of-state investor look. In fact, the city of Indianapolis, it has 19% of its single-family rentals are owned by out-of-state investors, which is the highest amount in the country. So the entire state has been kind of a haven for investors who not all the time make good landlords, particularly because they may not have local property management. We have seen certainly an increase in issues around substandard housing conditions, prices, different items like that. And this is really part of a longer cycle that we have seen here in the state of Indiana, where the Indiana General Assembly has for about the last 10 years passed a series of bills that have really taken away a lot of tenant rights. And that relationship between the landlord and the tenant is no longer an equal one. It's heavily weighted in favor of the landlord. The state has taken away the right of cities to be able to conduct effective rental inspection programs. The state took away the right for cities to mandate affordable housing development. And then we saw, you know, during this year's session where the Indiana General Assembly overrode their own Republican governor's veto on SCA 148, which completely gutted all local housing code, you know, across the state. So what we need to see is our Indiana General Assembly remember that they don't just represent investors and corporate landlords, but that they also represent tenants. And we need to see significant change at the state level.
Well, we're going to take a quick break in a moment. But Brandon, what is it that what is in it for folks in the General Assembly to pass these kinds of laws?
Well, I can't speak too much on policy. I can just say, you know, from the client's perspective, we represent, which are, you know, low income Hoosiers. You know, we do see that, you know, with the lack and with local control going away, that's been more of a challenge. We've had some data and some experiences from having basically just the simple notion that local government knows what's best for localities. And so I think that's been something to, I guess Amy's last point, has certainly been a challenge for our clients.
Up next, we'll take a look back at some of the other conversations we had this week, including one on why ambulances and emergency workers across the state are dangerously underfunded. If you want to get in touch with us, you can always reach out to us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobel. We'll be back after a quick break in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. It's the Friday recap where we look back at some of our favorite conversations this past week. Up next, we find out why many say ambulances and emergency workers across the state are dangerously underfunded. We're joined now by two guests from the Indiana Emergency Medical Services Association, Executive Director Gary Miller and President Nate Metz. Welcome to you both. Gary, we'll start with you. We've been talking on this program about a lot of the issues around EMS, particularly that the system is underfunded and understaffed and all of those consequences. What is your main concern or concerns right now when you look at everything happening?
Well, obviously, the shortage of paramedics and EMTs is by far at a critical stage, and we really need to take some action on that. In order to do that, it seems like money is behind a lot of solutions, and there is a very difficult areas in getting proper funding. In particular, Medicaid in the state of Indiana is paying ambulance providers the same rate as they did in 1976. For numerous reasons, it's never gone up. Also, some of our large insurance providers have dramatically cut the reimbursement rate for ambulance services. So I think it's a double whammy with the funding, which obviously creates the lack of ability to for ambulance services to pay more, which of course affects their staffing and the ability to hire paramedics and EMTs.
So I have to go back and ask you about this. The same rate as what was paid in 1976.
Yes, and we've been trying for years to get that increase, but one of the problems is Medicaid primarily looks at access to care as one of their prime motivations when they decide to raise rates. For example, dentists, if all of a sudden they find a lot of dentists are not taking patients because Medicaid patients because their rates are so low, they can just refuse to take patients. EMS does not fall into that situation. It's by law. We have to respond to every call we get, regardless of their ability to pay. And so because we have a duty to pay, Medicaid knows that these patients are being transported, which is, I think, one of the reasons why we fall below their radar when it comes to increasing their reimbursement rates for us.
And Nate, what about you? What are you seeing as the most immediate problems that need to be addressed in Indiana?
Well, I mean, I'd have to agree. I mean, the acute issue right now is being able to find professionally trained staff to fill ambulances. That's the biggest issue our organization faces. That's the biggest issue that a lot of the organizations around me face. And that's what we're seeing. And whether those individuals are leaving the field because they're burned out or they have better opportunities to take care of their families, that's part of the issue. And then recruitment is part of the issue. Training and getting individuals through the programs is part of an issue. There's far fewer educational programs in the state of Indiana now than there were several years ago to train these individuals to become EMTs and paramedics. And that's by far the biggest issue that we're facing right now. That's the fire in the room that needs to be put out. Will fixing that issue right offhand be a sustainable answer? No, I don't think it will be, not unless there's some significant overhauling to the reimbursement system and the financial incentives that come along with an antiquated EMS system that we've been living with for some years now.
Do you think that the pandemic, I mean, I know I'm asking everyone the same question, but did that highlight sort of these disparities in the system? I mean, I just can't wrap my head around, like, the payments are the same from 1976 for some of these things. Was this, would this not have been brought to light as it has currently if we weren't in a pandemic?
Well, I think, you know, necessity is the biggest motivator, right? We have a tendency to only react to crisis. This was on the radar for many, many years. As Gary mentioned, we've been going to the State House and the courthouse and raising this alarm for many years now. We saw the trends. We knew it was going this direction. The pandemic, I think, accelerated it faster than what we expected. You know, and so it's not all on the pandemic. I just think it accelerated and exacerbated the issue to the point to where it's a crisis. And now we are getting people to pay attention.
So it's almost like you've been warning about this potential happening for years, and it now it's happening.
Yes, that's correct.
If you have any questions or comments for our guests, you can always send them to us via Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. Or you can leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. Gary, how does funding generally work for EMS?
As the other two speakers mentioned earlier, Dr. Kaufman and Dr. Putnam, we get paid a base rate and then a rate paid per loaded miles of the service if we transport the patients. We've seen a little bit of relief thanks to Dr. Kaufman's efforts working with Medicaid earlier this year during the pandemic to give us a little bit of relief in that area. But still, Medicare and the majority of the providers still pay just a base rate based on the level of care that's being provided, basic life support compared to advanced life support, and then a little bit on the transport per mile. So it's primarily considered a transportation service rather than a medical treatment service, which is by far one of the real areas we want to concentrate on getting that changed by the payers. I do want to throw one other thing in here, too, is some of the insurance companies want to force providers to become in-network, if you will, and that really doesn't work on ground ambulance transportation. And so that is kind of what's leading to a lot of surprise billing for ambulance patients who receive care because providers have to shift their costs to the individuals rather than relying on the low amount that the insurance companies are paying.
Well, we have a listener comment from Wendell who says he works as a paramedic and says the pandemic shortage in Indianapolis is a crisis. Wendell says this has led to neighboring counties sending workers in to help and that they can't wait for long-term solutions. What kinds of short-term solutions are there for workers like Wendell? I don't know who wants to take that, Nate.
Well, I think the pause was appropriate, right? It's very difficult to come up with an immediate quick fix solution. And I feel for the paramedic because I see it in my staff every day. I think it was Dr. Putnam and Dr. Kaufman both mentioned that the individuals who have worked in this field traditionally over the you know, last several decades and probably since it started, they are very, very much motivated by a passion to help other people. And what you've seen over the years is, and I like to reference it to a trauma metaphor. Whenever we're taking care of children and traumas, we always say that as a provider, we have to look out for a very quick decompensation of that patient. In other words, they manage to keep themselves in a normal condition, and then all of a sudden it drops out from underneath of them. Well, all of these paramedic providers have been essentially keeping the entire system, the weight of the whole system, the broken system, on their shoulders for decades now. And after the pandemic, they're tired. Their families are suffering. Their mental health is suffering. They're succumbing to mental health and even in some cases, substance use disorders and post-traumatic stress disorders. So they're tired and they do need relief right now. And I wish I had an answer for them. We got to try to find independent solutions, work with the EMS Commission to allow us to try to find new creative ways to service our clients and our patients who are in need. And we really need a lot of patience from our community and a lot of support from our community.
I don't know if I have an answer for you as far as a quick solution for tomorrow, because even trying to get new providers into the field, it takes a minimum of 3 to 6 months to get an EMT, and it could take 18 months to get a new paramedic. So even trying to get new people into the field, we're talking a year from now before we could get new people in. Perhaps we could put enough money and an influx of cash to try to attract some of the providers who have left the field for non-skilled positions. That might be a good solution, but I can tell you that the paramedics and the EMTs who are in the field right now, they're tired. And if we don't provide them relief, the problem is going to continue to get worse, because now instead of people leaving for that better pay, they're going to be leaving because it's less stressful and they know that their bodies can't take it or their minds can't take it if they keep pushing themselves to the levels that they're pushing themselves each day, and they're doing it in the name of their communities. But I wish I had an answer for you for a quick solution. I think locally is probably our best answer for that.
Well, on that note, Gary, we have a question from Lance on Facebook who asks, is there anything a non-licensed person can do to help the EMT service?
I think one thing that we're finding more and more is that ambulance services in general are trying to hire usually you want to be an EMT before you ride in the ambulance. And by law, to ride in the back of the ambulance, you need to become an EMT. But a lot of non-licensed ambulance services are hiring ambulance drivers, if you will, which would be non-certified personnel who's, even though they're caring for the patient, they still rely on the EMT. So that's about the only option I see is that to be able to become a driver position rather than the tech in the back of the ambulance.
So is there anything like fire departments that have volunteer firefighters? There's nothing like a volunteer EMT?
There are. Throughout the state, there's several. And those areas that rely on volunteers in particular are extremely grateful for the EMT, the volunteer services, because it really is filling a much needed need, basically. And so there are volunteer services, and you would have to contact your local volunteer service to see if they would be willing to take on non-certified personnel.
Are you seeing, Nate, at all that more folks are interested in this field of work, or does it seem like people are leaving more than they're joining?
Well, I think the numbers show that we're losing providers quicker than we're bringing them in. I do think that there is perhaps an interest in exploring emergency medical services, and I'm only speaking from experience with my own application processes. With individuals looking for work right now, I think if we could target the appropriate individuals or demographic of individuals, whether that be age or area or current position in life, we might be able to recruit people more to come in. But again, finding an EMT program for them to go through, finding a way to pay for that EMT program for that individual so that they don't have to put the money up themselves. Finding a way to pay for their time in class, so that way they're not trying to split between making a living for their family and also going to school. I think all of those things would have to be necessary for us to capitalize on what I see as an increased workforce who are looking for career changes that exist right now.
And if I may add, the one thing I believe all four of us guests today have made ambulance trips ourselves and worked as EMTs or paramedics. And it is a highly rewarding job. The ability to help other people is just very rewarding. The ability to really make a difference in people's lives is something I think everybody hopes for in a career. Unfortunately, when they go home at the end of the day and they can't pay their bills, I think that's what really is forcing a lot of them to look to different careers.
We have a listener voicemail from Michael who says he's a former EMT with suggestions on what Indiana could do better. Let's take a listen.
Hi, my name is Michael. I'm calling from Evansville and former EMT back in 86. And one of the things I think that Indiana could do a better job on is emergency medical dispatch, which allows callers to speak to a qualified dispatcher. Far too many of the 92 counties in Indiana do not provide that because they're run by law enforcement who refuses to do that. As a way of information, not only was I an EMT, I was also a Indiana EMS commissioner appointed by the governor for 3 different terms. So thank you. Have a good day.
Okay. Any thoughts?
Yeah, I think Dr. Kaufman addressed this slightly in that what you're trying to do is you're trying to match up the need for what the calls are coming in as and what vehicles you're going to send. What Michael was alluding to in the telephone call was that at dispatch, some high functioning dispatch centers are able to weed out trips that somebody may be calling, and instead of sending an ambulance out to see what the issue is, they may be able to set them up with something not as critical, perhaps a doctor's appointment later on, or perhaps a non-emergency ambulance responding maybe in an hour from now rather than immediately. And that is the dispatch centers. I see some dispatch centers that really use that, and it does help with the workload and the functionality of the service.
Yeah, that does sound like a one solution possibility. Before we wrap up here, we have about a minute and a half left. I was wondering, is there another solution, maybe using medical students to participate in this as part of their training or something?
Yeah, so I mean, we engage with a couple of universities, and we do a lot of ride-alongs with medical students, even individuals who are in school to become an MD. Right now, the rules that manage EMS would not allow us to rely on those individuals as an asset for our communities alone without also already having the preset number of assets that are warranted to be on an ambulance. So while that is a solution that a lot of different communities use, particularly like in homeless shelters and places like that to help extend access to care, right now the rules and regs would not allow us to rely on those resources alone.
So it sounds like there's still a lot of conversations and processes to work through in the coming years.
That's probably an understatement, but yes.
Well, I want to thank you both for joining us. Gary Miller is Executive Director of the Indiana Emergency Medical Services Association, and Nate Metz is President of the group. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our Managing Editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.